Welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled John Dorsey is Really Good at Writing John Dorsey Poems. And it's about a poet that I try to copy stylistically, but I'm not very good at doing so, which thankfully, John Dorsey is very good at writing John Dorsey poems, so I don't have to. And he's here because our guest for this episode is someone who knows something about writing John Dorsey poems. John Dorsey, thank you so much for coming and being part of the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me. I feel like at times I'm copying myself at this point if you do it long enough.
Well, you know what though? That's I we'll get right into it. I'm teaching a poetry workshop right now. And these are all this poetry workshop one. A lot of them are, some of them are creative writing minors. Some of them do take it very seriously. Some of them are honestly students who need the writing intensive course for the gen ed curriculum, but they're really invested too, actually. It's a really cool vibe. And one thing they don't understand yet that I keep saying to them, and they don't believe me, is that if you work at a poetic voice long enough, you just think in that form, right?
No, you do. You do. And you think, and when you read other people's poems, you think about how sometimes you think about how you would have written that poem in your own particular language. I actually spoke to a group of creative writing students as well as a poetry workshop a week ago at St. Louis Community College.
Yeah, how did that go? How did they take sort of ideas about craft and voice, and what
It
did
was
you say to them
interesting.
that I could totally steal and then tell my students, like with my own advice?
We didn't, we talked about craft a bit, not so much voice. We talked a lot about publishing, and we talked a lot about just why they were there, their expectations of the class. And I was straight up with them. I told them that I realized that some students are there because they need the credit. It's required for their major, and that's okay. It's okay to be there. You don't have to feel bad about that. And it actually inspired some fairly lively conversations. I think, like, you having done this for your life, know that it's sometimes it's hard to get like a few words out of students, particularly if it's in the morning. And so they really, there was a lot of conversation. It was a lot of fun, which I will be honest, I've been reading at colleges for about 20 years. And I don't always have the best time. But St. Louis Community College was pretty fantastic. And I just kind of made it clear to them that this is not an easy path, but if it's something that you feel like you must do, then I just feel like it's something that you can do. And we talked a lot about that.
Yeah, I do. I mean, one of the things I do want to get into is like I admire that DIY model that you seem to follow, and that yeah, you tour a lot, you publish a lot. You have great perspectives, I think. I remember a Facebook post, which is again a thing, I think a lot of times, so students are can be quiet because they're so afraid of saying the wrong thing, or they're so afraid of rejection. And you had made a comment about, you submitted something to a journal and they didn't like it, and then you read the journal, it was like, oh, this is what they were looking for. And to have that confidence to know it's like it's not about quality, it's about the vibe. And my students are
Yeah, that
totally, my students are still stuck at like poetry is something dead people wrote.
yeah, and that's the one thing I do when I speak at a college is that I try to bring poetry into the present. And I think the way that I write primarily is very present tense. I think that also when you go in and read poetry, a lot of people don't know how to project properly, and I've had people come up to me and say, I didn't know poetry could be this, because they have that particular idea of like some dead language. So it always, like, I always say that if you reach one person when you do like a college lecture or reading, whatever it is, wherever you are, if you reach one person, truly reach them, then you've done your job.
Absolutely. And to just, I think even just the example of being a living poet in their
Yes.
space is so important. And that it, diminishing that barrier of access or that barrier of expectations that, like, no, you can do it. You know, you can be it. Like, you can, if you want to pursue this, yeah, it's not hard, but it's possible. And I feel
Yeah,
like
I.
sometimes that's one of the thresholds with my classes that, like, if I could just get them to that, and then they could figure out their voice in the next 20 years and they'll be fine.
Yeah, I brought a stack of like leftover books that I didn't particularly need, that I wasn't really pushing anymore, and I passed them out and I was like, you can have these. And I also brought some like regional anthologies from around like the St. Louis area, and I was like, this is stuff that's happening like 10 minutes from where we are right now. Because I didn't want them to think that it's some foreign land, like this is stuff that's happening far away. It's right there in their community, and I wanted to emphasize that.
Yeah, and I think that's so important, you know, and people grow up with pop culture and people grow up with the blockbuster and the canon and all of these things that just seem so deeply inaccessible. And so that's so cool. You mentioned about sort of writing in the present tense. And actually that's one of the things when I say, like, I try to, like, follow you stylistically, or I admire you stylistically, is with some of your poem with the poems. Yeah, again, I was rereading two of your books to get ready for this. How, you know, you write from memory, and you know, some of the poems in how do you pronounce it? Holocaust ag agave, agave, agave,
Yeah, agave. Yeah, like
agave.
agave and tequila.
Oh, of course, yes. You know, some of them have dates on them, you know, 1990, you know, the first poem, not the first poem, but, you know, 1994 haiku faces trailers, Trailer Park Song 1986. And there's a series of trailer park. But what I admire is your ability to, with very stark language and very briefly, recall a memory that I, as a reader, feel like I'm a part of.
It's about all of that is about using accessible language and creating a memory that someone can tap into. Like, if my memories were only applicable emotionally to me, I don't see the sense in publishing them and making them available to other people if there's not something there for them. I tell young writers all the time that you go ahead, you write your poem. Because 9 times out of 10, whatever your reader takes away from the experience, is going to be different than what you intended, and that is okay. It's about their experience at that point.
Yeah, that is so super important. Actually, could we hear some poems? Could we hear a couple? Like, you know, since I'm geeking on style.
Sure. I will read a few recent poems. I wrote this poem about growing up in Greensburg, which is where I'm from. And I used to have to take the transit authority everywhere. But this is a poem called The smokestacks are empty, and Jan Beatty is drenched in sunlight.
Oh, okay.
It's actually, yeah, okay. In the morning, the bus is nearly empty, and the sky is quiet and gray. Your hands aren't cracked and bleeding like your father's on that very same morning. Love is an alternate universe where it becomes clear why we do things, why the frost keeps coming with its work ethic in full view. Your father is an old crow. You're a hummingbird, tossing poems out of a bus window and into the morning sun, a feeder that gives off nothing but youth.
So good.
Okay, read another one out of here. Let's see here. I'm trying to think. All right, I'm going to read two more out of this little thing. I wrote this sitting in a bar called Wesley's Bar. It's in Toledo. I lived in Toledo for 12 years. This is called Monday Night at Wesley's Bar. It's raining outside, and you go in looking for anyone you once knew. But it's been years since you've felt joy in a place like this. And the world is just less kind than it was a decade ago. You listen quietly while a guy sits there talking about how he hates the waitresses at the Waffle House who complain about their shitty tips on New Year's, not even considering that they have mouths to feed that aren't his. And something about this just feels off. Because it's not even Halloween, and your plastic cup of off-brand cola has gone flat, and you just want to smack him right in the teeth for not acting like more of a human being at the end of a lousy football game, up on the TV in Spanish subtitles. Your grandfather used to say that everything was lousy. The mere thought of him on a night like this is the only thing that makes you smile. And suddenly you want to get up and turn around and leap off your stool in search of humanity and waffles. I was going to read another poem out of here. This poem sort of Pittsburgh centric. It was just in Flying Island magazine, which is operated by the Indiana Writers Center. And it's called Poem for Jeff Rudy. And Jeff was a clerk at Walden's Books in the old Greengate Mall, who really introduced me to a lot of things. And I, wherever he is, I hope he's all right. I don't know where you are now. Maybe your ponytail has gone gray. Maybe your thick glasses are smudged with the dust from old books, and you can no longer see your way out of the worry that comes with age. Maybe you no longer swim in rivers flooded with thoughtfulness as far away as Pittsburgh or Johnstown, where you once sang about the mythology of weathered hands, where I once dreamt of you painting your nails in a torn t-shirt while reading Jim Daniels. It must have been a dream. Your shirts were always freshly pressed, and you only read Larry Levis and Ed Ochester like it was a religion. And when you extended your hand, I took it. And it's been over 30 years with you now somewhere lost in time. And I am still waiting for you to let go.
I love how your poems, there's also this like, this really profound emotional core that you get in touch with. With whether that experience, thinking, meditating on a person, going into a bar, that bus ride. I admire that so much. It's what makes John Dorsey really good at writing John Dorsey poems.
Well, I suppose someone has to be.
Well, I think I'm thankful that you are. What's your process like?
Well, it used to be when I've been doing this since I was about 13, and it used to be that I would write a poem after I came up with a title for a poem. Somehow it spurred the entire thing. Now, these days, I keep like what I would call like a memory logbook. And I just write down a memory about something and then I'll go back to it. And that becomes the core of the poem. I hate to say, like, a lot of times now, like, it's a very professional system with me. Like, I have a lot of people that approach me about the publishing end of things. So I will generally, if it's someone I want to work with, I'll ask them to give me 8 weeks and I'll use that 8 weeks to assemble at a collection. A lot of times that's thematic because it helps me work faster if I'm working in a theme. But yeah, generally, like in terms of like just how I write one individual poem, it's that I keep just memories and then I'll check off, okay, I use this memory in a poem and I try not to use the same thing more than once. And that memory spurs the whole poem.
Oh wow. What about just like the mechanic? Do you write by hand? Do you type? Do you type on a phone? Like,
I don't type on a phone, first off. That sounds exhausting. I will type on my laptop. I still handwrite poems as well. And I kind of go between the two, between a computer and just handwriting things. For years, I wrote on a typewriter, and that's how I really got started. Because when I was 12, my mom bought me this massive, like, tank-sized Smith Corona typewriter. And so it started there, but now I handwrite stuff, I type it on the computer, but I hate cell phones so much. So any excuse not to use them more than I have to.
That totally makes sense. I will say I've played this trick on myself where if I can screen capture it at 11 point font and all the lines fit on the phone and the whole poem fits on the phone, that's a way of tricking myself into being brief, which is why I asked that. But do you find though, like handwriting and typing, does your brain feel different? Does the output feel different? Because for me, it does feel like whatever the tool I'm using is, something different happens.
Yeah, I think definitely when you still go about like handwriting notes for a poem, there's an intimacy there that is not there when I use my laptop. It's just a connection that takes me back to being like a 15-year-old kid who's writing these really terrible poems that he thinks are mind-blowing. But there's something sentimental and beautiful about that. And so I try to just scribble into a notebook, probably not as often as I should, but I try to, go about the process that way when I can.
That's cool. Yeah. And it's like also thinking about like which one of those things is an extension of you. I sometimes think about that. Like what? And maybe this is just because I had baggage because I had a third grade teacher who thought I had a neurological disorder because of my handwriting. But like which one feels effortless sometimes? I don't know. But yeah, so in terms of like you thinking about publishing, I mean, it's another admirable thing about you is I think could you talk a little bit about sort of your model of publishing and especially the sort of how many of your things are on these sort of limited, not sort of are on limited edition chapbooks and collections and sort of how you manage that aspect of poetic life.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer in limited edition books. Like, most of what I have out there that's not limited, Was published by a gentleman, or is published still by a gentleman named Jason Reberg, who runs a press in Kansas City called Spartan Press. And I work with Jason because I love him, because he's an amazing human being. But for the most part, if it wasn't him, I would not do things that are print on demand. I love the idea of a book as a piece of art, aside from the content inside the book. So that's really, yeah, that's my motivation and all of that. And, you know, I told some students this, I'd love poetry more than when I was 15 years old. I love it more now. So I don't know. That's the core reason why I publish as much as I do. Another thing that I've done over the last several years is start a subscription service to my work, where a lot of years I'll put out like 8 to 10 books. And if people send me $100, then I just send them all the books I do in a year. And one of the reasons I do that, I don't really make much money off of that, but it's to motivate myself to put that content out into the world, and it keeps you working. You
That's
know,
so cool.
my grandfather, his father, they all worked in factories, and I think I've sort of applied that factory mentality to poetry without hopefully giving up any quality at the same time.
No, definitely not. But I get that, and I think, yeah, I'm thinking about, yeah, you grew up in Greensburg, and how it was funny. Not long after I moved here, I made friends with some folks who moved here, and like they had lived in several different places in the country, and then they were in Pittsburgh because of school. And they said about how like this was the only place they had ever lived where one of the first questions when you meet somebody is, what do you do for a living? That sense of work is so like, and there's like, oh, and we were joking how there's even like these like sort of layers of Catholic guilt on top, St. Joseph, that wasn't even his kid, and he still went to work every day.
Yeah, no, that's all true. I mean, my family, going back at least like five generations, have all worked in Braddock. You know, at the Edgar Thomson Works, or I think my great grandfather worked at Westinghouse for a while. So,
I get you. I saw I'm in the East End, so I'm near both of those things.
okay.
Or pass both of those things every day, almost. Yeah.
One of the more interesting readings I've ever been to, Jason Baldinger gave me a ride from St. Louis back to Pittsburgh one time, and we wound up at this reading that was a benefit for the IWW in Homestead. So that was, yeah, it was pretty fascinating.
I know what you're talking about, and I missed that, unfortunately. But yeah, and it's weird to think like, yeah, the new Pittsburgh, old Pittsburgh, yeah, the Homestead Works is now a dying shopping center.
That's somehow fitting and sad at the same time.
It really is. I mean, I think, there's something about Western Pennsylvania, and I'm thinking about this in terms of poetics of place. And I know, you've been living in Toledo, and of course, there's, I think, our mutual connection with Jason Baldinger there, and his work, kind of thinking about urban decay and Rust Belt decay, and like the presence of the past, or is it the persistence of the past, where you just see it everywhere?
I mean, there's really something about Western Pennsylvania that really brings that out. Toledo too. I mean, Toledo is a big like factory town with their Jeep plant and the glass plant. And I think I've had opportunities to live in other parts of the country that I didn't take, and I think something keeps me in like a very working class industrial setting.
Yeah, it does constantly feel like home. And I didn't grow up here. I grew up in New Jersey, but grandma's house was in Johnstown. And the 2 weeks I would spend out there every year, I felt like I was in a different world.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
it was the world I chose to live in, I guess. But yeah, there's just something about those places.
Yeah, I had a really, really touching sort of heartfelt moment with a writer from Pittsburgh named Julia Spiker Kasdorf. And she and I, we were on an online reading together, but we had both gone to Hemfield High School, except that she's probably about 15 years older than me. And she's actually written a really interesting book of poems that's all about fracking.
Oh,
No, but she and I started to we started to like cry together. We had this really emotional moment about how when we were both going to that high school, we felt like we were completely alone in the world. And it was interesting to meet someone else who had gone through that experience in the same general area.
yeah, it. Well, I mean, fracking is this sort of new thing. It's. I was driving the country and I drove past a fracking rig, and I was reminded of this like commercial that they were showing. That was like, oh, this is the new future, and like young people will stay. And it was this like weird, like you're destroying the earth, but you're tapping in the nostalgia at the same time.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah, Julia, she's an interesting person. She teaches, I believe, for the University of Pittsburgh, but their campus in Moon Township.
Oh, okay, yeah. I'll have to check her out and check that book out because I am fascinated about this, and our former governor. Two governors ago now, who wanted to like turn, he said, we can turn Pennsylvania into the Saudi Arabia of natural gas.
Huh.
She
Which
was like,
governor was that?
that was Tommy Corbett. That was good old
Okay.
midterm Tommy.
All right. All right. Yeah, I'm glad it wasn't Ed Rendell, who I have a soft spot for, because I went to college in Philadelphia and he is beloved.
Yes. Fast Eddie.
Yeah, he's definitely that.
Yeah, I think my wife sold him a t-shirt once at Penn's Landing.
He once, when I was in college, I was somewhere and I'd forgotten my wallet, and he once bought me a steak sandwich. So that's what I think of when I think of him.
Oh, wow. That's a cool memory.
Yeah, just.
So, I want to talk about. So what kind of projects do you have upcoming? We and I'll have links to these. We went through this conversation already before I started
Sure, yeah.
recording, but if you can tell the people, like, you have some readings coming up. You actually have what, one, two, three books in the works?
Well, I don't know. Several.
Several.
I've got a book coming out April 1st on Tangerine Press, which is based in London. And this is my fourth book with them. That's called Farewell Tour. And basically, the title just comes from my aunt used to take me to a lot of concerts around Pittsburgh. And it seemed like every 3 or 4 years, Kiss would have a farewell tour, but they never went away. So that's the most upcoming thing I have, the most that'll happen soon. I'm doing a project with Jack White's publishing label, Third Man Books. And it's. They had this vending machine that they refer to as the Literarium. And the Literarium is in their London record store. And basically, they put together chapbooks, throw them into the vending machine, and then you pay your money, and you could get any book that's in the machine. You don't know what you're going to get. So that's really pretty fascinating. And so
That's
I've got
wild.
that. I've got that. I'm trying to think of what else. I have a book of short stories, which I do not do anymore, but these are from 20 years ago, called Kissing Frogs with Tongue, which will be out on a press called Back of the Class, which is in St. Louis, sometime at the end of May. So yeah, just pretty busy in general, and I've got the readings, so.
Yeah, you're going to be at Daredevil Records in Niagara Falls on March 21st. So I guess that is that the
Yes.
equinox? No, 20th is the equinox.
Well, yeah, and then the 22nd, I'll be at Max Bax in Coventry in Cleveland. And then I basically have readings scheduled every month through, I think, November right now. In fact, I will be July 23rd, I'll be reading for Hemingway's in Pittsburgh. And then at the end of September, and I don't remember what date this is, I will be reading as part of Jason Baldinger's reading series. They're the Odd Month series.
Ah, yes, the last was it the last Saturday in December, in September.
Yeah, I think it's like September 28th, but don't quote me on that. I need to go back and I write everything down, but I can't remember it offhand.
And that's fine. And I have a calendar handy, but it's a little far away. But yeah, and that's at Bantha Tea, and which is such a cool space, and it is such a cool both Hemingway's and Odd Month are such cool reading series. So it'll be I'm looking forward to seeing you here in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to being there.
And so what's the best way? And again, try to have links to individual projects or if there's event pages on the website when I post it, but what's the best way to sort of follow what you do and if people want to find out more and
Facebook is probably the best way, and I would, I'm open to anyone friending me that's genuinely interested in poetry and stuff like that. So Facebook is the best way. I am on Instagram and I'm there more and more lately. So
It
there's
is the
that.
less ragey platform.
Yeah, I deleted my Twitter account because it's just a cesspool.
Yes.
But I like Instagram. It connects me with a lot of younger writers, and if you're going to keep doing this, you can't just connect with the people your age. You got to keep expanding just who you talk to out there. So there are a lot of younger people on Instagram, so it's awesome.
Yeah, no, it's yeah. But I guess then I don't know about TikTok. I'm not getting a TikTok. That's where I draw the line.
Yeah, I'll also say if there's anyone out there in the universe that needs a slightly used beat up poet to come like speak to their class, that's another way that I reach out to people, and I love doing that. So there's that too.
Excellent, excellent. Could you read some more poems for us? Is there got some more
Yeah,
poems handy?
I can do that. Let's see here. I'm gonna read this poem. It's about the town that I live in now, which is in the Ozark Mountains, a little bit outside St. Louis. But the town that I live in, it's 99.9% white. That's not why I moved here by any means. But at their town fair a year or two ago, I saw a girl that was wearing a Tupac Shakur t-shirt. And my first thought is, like, where the hell did she even get that shirt? So I wrote this poem in response to that. It's called East Coast, West Coast in Southern Missouri. A high school girl with thick black glasses and a baby bump barely concealed by a secondhand Tupac t-shirt stands on the front of her lawn. As a volunteer fireman who didn't make it past the ninth grade throws candy in her direction. With a pitching arm that will never take him any further than the next county over. A love story held together with tape, like the glasses peeling in the summer sun. Candy corn at her feet, like stray bullets in a gang war, in a music video that will last the rest of her life. A baby under each arm, pacing east and west, a drive-by that goes in circles leading nowhere, always in rivalry with possibility. Maybe the old owner of the shirt fed the hungry, danced in an empty swimming pool, and swore there was music that nobody else could hear. Or maybe she actually saw who killed Tupac and Biggie both and never said a word, because there was peace in just letting things go. Like the boy who placed the shirt over her shoulders as she shivered, taking what she hadn't offered to begin with. Because when you wash out the blood stains, all you're left with is your own heartbreak, standing on your front lawn, wearing someone else's dream, shrunken down so many times with wrinkles you can never quite smooth out, until you're almost invisible, with a snow cone melting down your arm in the sun, bleeding red, white, and blue, as a single sock fresh out of the dryer sticks to your belly, and that's the best part of your day.
Awesome.
Let's see here. All right. You know, when I was growing up, we lived in a trailer park for a long time. And when I was a kid, that was sort of a blemish on you. But now it's more of like a point of pride. So, but I wrote this poem, and it's about that at points. It's called The Double Wide Book of the Dead. The Double Wide Book of the Dead. Our house wasn't nearly that big, with its cheap plaster walls, where I covered my bedroom with posters for long-forgotten 80s hair bands, and built a temple to suburban poverty, where with awful ghost stories scribbled into yellow legal pads, with awful poems about pale girls scribbled into yellow legal pads. It was all doll ink and Saturday morning cartoons and reduced lunch tickets with peanut butter sandwiches and tomato soup every day, and dreams hidden away in pencil boxes, and coins tossed into shopping mall fountains, and girls with hips as wide as jelly bracelets. You could only corral so many spirits into such a tight space, until the dead started to look like you, like your mom or your dad, when they were your age, when they looked for answers in sad songs too, in broken houses where the dead had just more room to roam and stretch their legs and dance. Let's see. Trying to think of where we are time-wise. I'll read you one more poem.
Do we have the time for a couple more? I just want to hear a couple more, if that's okay.
Sure.
And then we'll get to the bottom five.
All right.
No, that line's going to haunt me.
This is, actually was going to read another poem, and I'm going to read this. It's a poem about my woodshop teacher in junior high who, well, you'll learn it from the poem, but he impregnated one of my classmates. So that's the sort of thing you never forget. It's a poem called The Bride of Frankenstein. My eighth grade shop teacher once sawed off three fingers in the same week, often sending us in search of his missing digits, promising extra credit to the lucky student who helped him sew them back on in the nurse's office. We were Frankenstein. He was the misunderstood monster with weak hands and bolts for brains. It was a few weeks before we noticed her potbelly, the new girl. She had transferred in mid-semester, rumor has it, to escape an abusive father. he in his mid-40s. It seemed strange to see them holding hands behind his weathered workbench. But what did we know? Their romance was a silent movie. Though if there had been any protest, they would have been hard to hear over the noise on the shop floor. As time went by, we noticed her stomach expanding, teaching us more at 14 than any health class ever could. One afternoon, the principal came in and asked us to wait out in the hall. He had us line up against a wall and walked quickly back inside. She was crying. An ugly princess in a flaming tower made of balsa wood that would never hold up against the weight of her own decisions. We took turns running up to the shop window, steaming the glass. When it was my turn, all I could see were the girl's parents screaming in slow motion and mouthing the words pregnant and slut. A few days later, a new teacher walked in and inspected our work. We said nothing. We found out over the summer that they had had twins, getting married in a quick shotgun service so he could avoid jail time, later moving in with his aging mother. She became the bride of Frankenstein. In a gown draped with faded pearls, she could never feel pure. His fingers touched her lips, but were too misshapen to ever wear a ring. Their love, like a lopsided birdhouse, never seemed to match up quite right. As years went by, people talked. We, the villagers, watching quietly as her future became invisible. Words hung like burning pitchforks on the tongue of God, more sad than angry that her dreams had not been sown on stronger hands.
Wow. No, that. Yeah. Small town scandal, small, or. Yeah.
I mean, Creepers. You can't. Yeah, you can't make these things up.
No. Yeah, I'm also teaching a fiction workshop this semester. There is that sort of weird thought of like, what's believable, and is writing poetry more interesting because you can write the incredible.
You know, people ask me where the poems come from, and it makes me chuckle because I think if you've lived long enough in this world, they're everywhere.
Yeah, and if you're willing to get out there and have experiences and interact with people, and also maybe just live in, every place is weird, isn't it?
It is. Everywhere is so different. When I travel across this country, I look out sometimes and I think, like, what are those people doing? Like, how is their life different than mine? You know, they're probably just going to pick up a pizza. They're going to Walmart or whatever. But something about it just seems so much more fascinating to me than my own life. I think it's the whole, like, the grass is always greener on the other side. You imagine these people to have, like, these amazing lives. But in a way they do, because we all have our own story. We all have stories like the poem I just read, like maybe not directly in our family, but we know someone. And I will say that, like, I'm not a firm believer in writer's block, because I believe that there's just so much out there that you can write about.
Absolutely. And I think there is that for people who are poets, you know, the sort of the Jack Kerouac recording angel impulse. And this question of, you know, because we had a computer teacher who was a creeper, and we had a middle school science teacher who was a creeper. And it is that, like, what do you do with those memories?
Well, if you're lucky enough to be able to write poems, that's what you do with them. That's my opinion. You know, I think that if you can write a poem, like, good quality of poetry, I guess, is subjective, But if you can write poems that people sort of tap into, they'll forgive you for almost anything. A lot of people, when they write poems, if it's about a particular person, they'll change the names or they'll change certain things. I don't really do that. I just write the poem as is and hope that people forgive me if it's something they view as a negative.
I think on that note, it's time for the bottom five. A series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and/or philosophical nature. Are you ready?
Yes.
Yeah, I'd love this forgiveness thing. Question one, it's a question everybody gets first time on the podcast. If reincarnation is real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease or illness would you like to be?
Huh, that's fascinating. I don't know. I think I'd like to be like maybe like gonorrhea or like an STD, something of that sort.
I like that. Miss is something born out of joy.
Yeah, like hopefully something that was pleasurable, but I'll also be something you would never forget.
Love it. Love it. Question number two. If you had to choose, would you welcome the total elimination of day or night?
Oh, that's fascinating. You sort of need night to be able to get to sleep. And I like sleeping. And I don't know. A lot of the best things that have happened to me in my life have happened at night, so I'm gonna go with nighttime.
That's a quality choice. I love it. Question three, what mundane daily activity gives you the most joy?
Oh, yeah. Well, this might make sense if you know me. Getting the mail.
I love mail.
I do too. And I started submitting to print magazines when I was a child, and your only option was to put together the printed out poems and you put together the self-addressed stamped envelope. And so you would anxiously wait by the mailbox to see like if someone had taken your poems. So that sort of never left me. And so the mail is like most people would consider it mundane, but it's my favorite part of the day.
I love mail. When's the last time you sent out a self-addressed stamped envelope?
Sometime in the last, because I'll send a few places left that only take hard copy, probably sometime in the last year.
Oh, that's fantastic. I got a band sticker. I think somebody was offering band free stickers if you sent them an SASE, and I was like, man, I love that. Yes, the self-addressed stamped envelope and the anticipation of that.
Something I picked up again during the pandemic is that I started to write people letters again, as a way to keep my own sanity. So I've kept up doing that. So I probably one of the few people left in America that still like sends letters.
I have aspirations of doing this, and in fact, I think I carry them around with me in my sort of work bag. The post office postcards with the postage like on the card. It's just a plain white card, but the stamp is printed directly on the card that you buy at the post office.
Yeah, I
I
have
really
some
want
of
to
those.
send people more of those.
Yeah, Jason Baldinger is a big, big fan of the postcard, and so
Yes.
I mostly have some of those because of him, I think.
So good. I wonder, well, it's 12. Our mail gets here around 2, so I have time. Question 4. What is your least favorite month?
Oh, my least favorite month would have to be the month of August. It's typically the hottest month of the year, and I am not someone that enjoys heat. Even though I love California, I love the city of New Orleans, which I can never live in because of the heat. But yeah, it just who wants to be like all sticky and sweaty? Yeah, the month of August, it could go away.
I'm with you. I'm with you all the way. And that's when I have to go back to work at the end of summer. Yeah. Screw August. August can just die.
It really can.
All right. Question 5. You're almost through this.
All right.
All right. What's the worst weather you have ever witnessed?
Oh, the worst weather I've ever witnessed. That's tough because I've been like all over the country, all over the world. I think that's a matter of like what sort of weather do you prefer? But we had some pretty bad winters growing up around Western Pennsylvania. But I think one of the worst things I've ever experienced, I was on a Greyhound bus that broke down in Wyoming in the middle of a snowstorm. And there also happened to be a guy on this bus who was like pissed drunk, who got kicked off the bus in the middle of the snowstorm, and they wouldn't let him back on, which was inhumane because it had to have been like 20 below outside. And yeah, I mean, probably some of the worst weather I've ever seen in my life anywhere at any time has been from a Greyhound bus or a bus stop. The people there are naturally inhospitable to begin with, and that doesn't help the weather at all.
Wow, that's 20 below and all right. I think that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and other services. Hopefully the YouTube thing, since Google Podcasts is going away, we'll be on that. We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook, and that's the only platform we're on right now. Thank you so much, John Dorsey.
Again, thank you so much for having me today. This actually been a lot of fun.
Yes, let's keep
Yes, let's
doing
keep
this.
doing.
Let's have a Baldinger-esque relationship where you just come back again and again. Every time something new comes out, or at least you reached a plateau of number of new things coming out. Let's just keep
Yeah,
doing this.
that sounds good. I'll let you I'll keep you apprised of everything.
Yeah, and hopefully I get to see you when you're in town.
Yeah, I don't see why you wouldn't, and I hope that I hope you do too, and I hope I get to see you as well.
All right. And finally, thank you so much, Andrew Fox, for the lovely theme music. Later, meets.
2, 3, 4.